Why don't I get you to introduce yourself, Derek, and who you are in relation to what we're about to talk about, or, you know, how long you've been living with cancer, that sort of thing.
Okay. My name's Derek Miller. I have a blog at penmachine.com. I'm a writer and editor, but for the past 4 years or so, I've had cancer, and that's taken over a lot of what I've been doing. So I guess that's what we're talking about today.
Tell me what happened last week.
Well, last Thursday, which was November 25th, Thanksgiving in the U.S., but not here, thankfully, my wife and I met with my oncologist at the BC Cancer Agency. And, well, it was no surprise. I sort of pried out of him the how long have I got, doc, answer, which even over 4 years has not usually been forthcoming because I've had a lot of different treatments. And I essentially asked him, do you seriously expect that I will still be coming to visit you here in your office in 2 years? And he said, honestly, no. So that's not saying I got 2 years to live. It probably means less. Nobody really knows how much less. Could be a year, could be 6 months, could be 18. Just depends on how things go. The main thing is I've taken a whole bunch of different treatments, mostly chemotherapy. And the one I was taking most recently hasn't really been working. And there's not a lot of other options left. So that's basically where I sit. The thing I found out, essentially, is that I'm going to die pretty soon. And I'm 41, so that's not what people expect.
The news wasn't a surprise to you, but is it the first time that somebody's put a number on it?
No. When I first got diagnosed, same doctor, I asked him... I've learned to ask the question more pointedly now, but I asked him, what does this mean? I have colorectal cancer. What, you know, how long am I likely to have if we don't get it? And he said, well, the way he put it was the median survival for this condition is 2 years. But that's the way doctors tend to talk because that's the way the studies work. And what median survival means is 2 years from diagnosis, about half the people are dead and about half the people are alive. So 2 years later, I was still around. And he was right that half the people are still around. And if I died, he would have still been right because half the people weren't. So that's not the same kind of answer most people are looking for. So he didn't tell me I had 2 years to live back then because I didn't, and he didn't really know. And again, nobody really knows for sure. You can look at the statistics, but that's averages for everybody who's got a disease. For an individual, it's a lot harder unless you're right near the end to say, how long has this person got? So this is the first time that they've said, well, we really don't have anything left we can try that's seriously likely to work.
How have you responded to treatment?
Do you mean how has my condition responded, or do you
well,
mean
let's,
how
let me
I
just
responded?
let me just back up for a second. Tell me what it is that's happening in your body right now.
Okay, well, it started off that I had colorectal cancer, which is essentially cancer in your lower intestine. Which I discovered I had in 2007, but I'd probably had in some form for a year or two or more, growing slowly. By the time we found it, it had already spread to other parts of my body, most notably my lungs, which is the bad part. That's when they call that stage four metastatic cancer. Once you've gotten to stage four, it's pretty unlikely that you can cure it and get rid of it. Nevertheless, I did have surgery because the main tumors in my bowel were, you could get rid of them, and they did, and that's why I, you know, didn't die in 2007. But the other metastatic cells were in my lungs and elsewhere, and they've kept growing ever since. And I've had I had radiation treatments, I had a couple surgeries, I've had a lot of different types of chemo and other chemical therapies and experimental ones and trial drugs and all sorts of things. And some of those have slowed things down, kept them stable for a while. Briefly, they shrank some of the tumors. But the overall pattern has been that stuff's been slowly growing and continuing to, and more tumors have shown up over the past 4 years. So that's basically where things are going. And it's mostly in my lungs and my chest.
So last week it was, along with this diagnosis, along with the how long have I got, doc, was there a decision to stop treatment of all kinds?
Well, not of all kinds, but certainly to stop the chemo I was taking, which is this particular one. You know, I've been through a lot of different chemos, and this one was especially brutal for whatever reason, whether because it was a stronger set of drugs. It was actually some drugs that I'd had before in a different combination. But it was a lot harder. It took me a lot longer to recover each time I had a treatment. I was having trouble keeping food down. I was losing a lot of weight. And it didn't seem to be doing anything as far as the tumors were concerned. So the logical decision is, you know, why keep going if it's just making you sick for no reason? But the thing is, there's not, you know, while there are other trials and other things that might come up, none of those is really all that likely to do anything. He even said to me, it's more, you know, if you were to try these other things that we've got in the pipeline right now, you would mostly be doing it just to, you know, help our studies rather than with any big likelihood of treating yourself. Lucy, quiet. What are you barking at? Come here. So, I mean, you know, I've already participated in a number of different trials, and you know, in these cases, they would be the type where they're doing a placebo-controlled trial, so that I wouldn't even necessarily be getting the drug. It would, part of it is just to see, you know, is it effective? Does it at all? Are there any interactions with other things? It's really, you know, very early stage stuff that's not likely to have much of a result. So, you know, maybe if there's something interesting, I might try it, but it's not too likely at this point. And it's, in this case, it's more up to me to decide. They're not saying, oh, you should try this, mm-hmm. which is what they've said before. So that tells me something too.
So it sounds like a silly question, but how are you feeling right now?
Physically, I'm feeling better because I'm not taking the chemo. Mentally, it's surprisingly, it's a bit of a relief because, you know, I guess I've known for a couple years that these treatments haven't been making the cancer go away. So that's told me, you know, I probably don't have that long. Probably don't have 10 years, probably don't have maybe 5 years. I was thinking maybe, but probably less than that. So this is, it's not a surprise, and it's kind of, I guess, it's getting out of that limbo state of, okay, are any of these things going to work or not? The answer is probably not. So obviously there's a lot to deal with emotionally and logistically and whatever else, but I feel like I'm ready to, you know, make some choices and live my life for as long as I've got.
And when you say make some choices, have you decided on how things are going to play out?
Not finally. That's something I, you know, it's something I got to talk more with my wife about, my family, my kids. I've talked about when things get really bad, which they eventually will. I don't want any heroic efforts to keep me on a ventilator or in a coma or something just for the sake of keeping me alive. I want to try and stay comfortable. I'm not really afraid of dying, but I'm afraid of suffering. I'm not afraid of death, but the process of getting there can be unpleasant, and I want to minimize that. So I'm thinking in those terms. And then once I do die, well, at that point, it's whatever works best for everybody who's left, because at that point, it won't matter to me. So that's sort of the terms I'm thinking of now. And then there's just a bunch of stuff to deal with, you know, plans to make, junk to get rid of, online stuff to shut down, things like that, which I've been thinking of for a while, but now I've really got to do it. So that's sort of where I'm sitting now. It's, you know, it gives me something to plan for, you know, whereas for the past few years, not knowing how long I'm going to live or not or whatever, you sort of wonder what you can plan for. You can't say, well, we'll go on vacation next summer, or we'll go somewhere in 2 years or 3 years, because I can't plan that far ahead. So it's been very day to day. You know, what am I going to do today? Do I feel well enough to go get some groceries? And for a while, at least, it's more likely that I will. So I can do that sort of stuff. You know, do stuff with the kids, walk the dog, have fun, meet, you know, go talk to people I haven't seen for a while. That's the sort of stuff I'm looking at now.
Tell me about the blog and why you started writing it in the first place. How long ago, is it one of those like blogs you just had to write something down? And I'm confusing a bunch of questions here. Why did you start writing it in the first place?
Well, I've had my blog for a long time, 10 years, a little more than that, and the website, which was sort of bloggy before that, before there was such a thing as a blog, I've had since 1997. I'm a writer and editor by trade. I've written compulsively since I was a little kid, but I've always wanted an audience. So I've never written a diary. I never found that useful. I always wrote for student newspapers and, you know, magazines, and I used to write instruction manuals, all sorts of stuff like that. I wanted people to read it. And I had been updating my website as a, you know, initially as a freelance writer as a way to get clients. And one of my friends said, hey, there's this software, Blogger, that lets you do that automatically instead of having to, you know, code all the pages by hand. And I thought, that sounds great. So I started writing it. And on average, I've written something there every day for 10 years. And so it's just become part of what I do. It's how I communicate with a lot of people. It's how I sort out thoughts in my head. It's how I write down things I might want to remember later if I can search through my website, because I vaguely remember something but don't know the details. So that's why I started writing it. And actually, when I was first interviewed for CBC about this back in 2007 on the coast, I guess it was, you know, they asked me, well, why did you start writing about your cancer? And the thing for me is that why would I not? Mm-hmm. First of all, I've read about most other things, and to not write about like the biggest thing that's ever happened in my life and now probably the end of it would be difficult, because what else would I write about? And plus, it makes it really convenient for all my friends and relatives and acquaintances. They can just read it and find out what's going on. They don't have to ask me every time, how's it going? They know. And I don't have to tell the same story over and over and over again. They can ask me something specific about what they want to know rather than just trying to get the story, which I keep up to date all the time. So I really haven't seen any particular downside to doing it. Other people, well, I don't know. I've been online a long time, mm-hmm. since I was a teenager. So I've got the privacy instincts of a 17-year-old. And I don't, you know, I've learned my lessons on what can go bad with that, but I learned that in maybe 1985. Mm. So I have a sense of what I should write and what I shouldn't. And I just, you know, I put it out there, and I don't feel like that's something I should be keeping from people.
But what do you make of the thousands of people who you don't know, who you've never met, who are reading the blog and commenting? And
well, that's the nature of the internet. You know, I read a lot of other websites of people I don't know, but I sort of feel like I know them because I have read them regularly for a long time. And there are people who feel that way about me, and I think that's great. I mean, as I said, I want an audience, and I've got one. And they're obviously interested because they keep coming back. The thing about that is, well, the most valuable thing about that, especially in recent days, I've gotten messages from people who've said, I've been reading your blog for years and you never know anything about me, but you know, you really helped me when my dad almost died last year and I had to read a bunch of stuff. I read a bunch of stuff on your blog and it helped me sort through the feelings I was having. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I have cancer and I just got diagnosed and I wanted to get a sense of what might happen. And, you know, mine might be a sort of semi worst case scenario, but at least they get a sense of what is it like to take chemo. What's it like to have surgery? What does this stuff really involve? Because unless you've been involved with this or had a relative, most people don't even know what having chemo means. You know, what's the process? Where do you go? How long does it take? What does it feel like? You know, is it needles? Is it pills? Whatever else? I didn't know that stuff. So it's useful for other people for me to write that down and for them to read it. So that's, you know, I'm happy to have people read it. There's a small number of people who write stuff to me that bothers me a bit, but that's the nature of the internet too. And it, you know, it's not something I take too much to heart.
Give me an example.
Well, the key example, there's a lot of people, and I wrote this in my post where I sort of announced that, you know, the end was near. There's a lot of people who seem very uncomfortable with the concept that somebody like me, who's fairly young and relatively healthy, could actually die from this. And you know, they have some particular miracle cure or some particular amazing treatment that their uncle or somebody they knew or some doctor in Germany or somebody else has that supposedly would cure everything, as well as diabetes and fibromyalgia and MS and every other condition, if you just drink this particular tea or something. You know, I'm sort of mashing them all together. I've gotten a lot of those, and I look into them because I have a biology degree and I've, you know, I know how to look at scientific papers, and most of them have no evidence behind them. And you know, there's a reason why the treatments that you get through the traditional medical establishment are the ones that you get, because they do have evidence behind them. And it does bother me that there are a lot of people out there who seem to think that people who've dedicated their careers to being cancer specialists are just trying to sell more drugs for big pharma or something. I don't think that's true at all. I deal with these people. A lot of these doctors and nurses have had cancer themselves. They have relatives who have cancer. They want to do everything they can to try and get rid of it. And they've tried what they can on me. For me, it's kept me alive a little longer. It doesn't look like it's going to keep me alive as long as I'd like. But a lot of other people, my dad, my aunt, my uncle, numerous friends I have, friends of my parents, have been cured. My dad had cancer 40 years ago, and it's been gone ever since. And, you know, he got treatment, and it worked. And for a lot of people, it does. It hasn't that way for me. But it does bother me when people think there's some grand conspiracy and that I should not be doing what I'm doing, and, you know, then I'd live longer. I don't think that's true. I mean, maybe there would have been something I could have done at some point if I'd had the thought to get screened 5 years ago, but there was no reason to do that. And it's bad luck for me, but I don't think it's a conspiracy that I've been sucked into. So that bothers me.
And beyond those people, beyond the fringes, what else are people saying to you about your latest blog entry or about Endgame in particular?
Well, it's been a lot of really supportive messages, comments, emails. I've gotten in touch with people I haven't talked to for years who just want to, you know, say hello because, you know, they haven't thought to do it now, and now's the time to do it. And just, you know, I've come to realize that the friends I've had for a long time really are spectacular friends for a lot of reasons. But just the kind of support they've offered me and given me and expressed. And then all the people I don't know who just take the time to write something to me. You know, it's been overwhelmingly good and positive and supportive. And I mean, even the people I was complaining about who were, you know, telling me, oh, you should do this, you should do that. They're not doing it maliciously. They're not saying, oh, you're stupid, you should not have done this. They want to help too, even though they don't know me. So it's not like I begrudge them for that. I don't necessarily agree, but, you know, pretty much everything. There's nobody who's been a troll who's just trying to get me angry. Nobody who's, you know, there are some spammers who annoy me, but they've been along all the time anyway, and they're not paying attention to what I'm writing. They're just trying to get more traffic by posting on my death announcement that you should buy some Manolo Blahnik shoes or something. But, okay, you know, that annoys me, but they're not even really, they're machines, not people doing that. So really everything's been supportive in some way or another, maybe not in the way I would want directly, but it's, so that's been astonishing. And just the amount of it, you know, I've got more than 100 comments on that one blog entry by now, and, you know, links on Twitter, hundreds of those, and things on Facebook, and emails and phone calls, and I've met, you know, I've gotten together with friends that I haven't seen in a while. So it's been and this is only in less than a week. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty impressive, I think. You know, it reinforces my opinion that people are genuinely good at heart in general, which you might not think if you're, you know, watching the news a lot. So when you deal with people in the real world, and I take the online world as part of the real world, you find out that's, you know, the world is not an evil place, I don't think.
Have you, I imagine over the past few years, as, I mean, I have no idea what it would be like to be in your position, how you might reassess, you know, what's important in your life. Has that shifted at all since last week? I mean, do the blocks get moved?
A little bit, but I mean, as I said, I've been thinking about this for a long time, mm-hmm. so it's not, it hasn't made any kind of seismic shift in how I'm thinking about things. It does make me try to make, and, you know, I'm not necessarily instinctively good at making other people a priority. You know, I think everybody's inherently selfish in a lot of ways, and I was an only child. I got to do my own thing for a long time, and in a lot of ways, most of my life has been pretty easy for me, you know, other than this stuff. But You know, I've never worried about where my next meal is going to come from or whether I'm going to have a place to live or anything like that. So I really have to turn my focus to my wife and my kids and try and do what's best for them in the long run, because that's ultimately what's going to matter. And that's obviously you want to do that always, but it's really important to do that now. And that's come up in stuff like, how do I want to plan what to do with my remains? You know, I would probably instinctively say, oh, well, I want to, well, I was thinking I should donate it to that Body Worlds exhibition because that would be cool. You know, as a nerd, that's really neat. But my family's not comfortable with that, so I'm not going to do it. You know, that sort of thing. Thinking more about what's important for them now and later and after I'm gone. That's something that's changed. And I hope I can continue to make that a priority while I'm around so that I'm not just, you know, when I was on chemo, it's, I tend to sort of retreat into a shell when I'm in pain or nauseated or whatever. I sort of go into my hole, and that's not good for anybody either. And I got to try and keep myself out of that while I can, especially if I'm feeling better, it's easier to do. Mm-hmm. And to talk about how I'm feeling about stuff and what I want to do and what other people want, that's some of the shift. And you do figure out what's important. I mean, I know I'm not one of these people who thinks that cancer could in any way be a good thing, but there are some silver linings in that I've been home on disability, which means I see my kids go to school, see them off in the morning. I'm here when they come home. I'm not at work. I've spent a lot more time with them doing stuff than I probably would have if I was working full time. One of my daughters is homesick today, and so I'm just home here, and I can make sure she's okay, and she's watching some TV, but, you know, I'm not having to arrange babysitting or take time off anything. I'm just here, and that's good, you know. Given everything, I'm glad that's the case. I would still rather it not be the case. I'd rather be healthy and working and see them a fair bit and get to see them go to high school and graduate and grow up, which I probably won't see. So, you know, it's not the best balance, but it's okay given the circumstances.
It's interesting, given everything you've been told about what's happening, you still say, which I probably won't see.
Well, that's funny. I guess I sort of take having been trained and interested in science for a long time, there's no absolutes. Strange things do happen. There are spontaneous remissions and whatever else. I don't expect any of those. It's almost certain that I will be dead within a year or two. And I know that. But it's not impossible that I might live longer than that. So for whatever reason, whether some treatment comes along or whatever, things slow down for whatever reason, that could happen. But I don't expect it. I don't expect it any more than I'm going to win the lottery. And I don't even buy tickets. So, you know, but somebody could give me $10 million just for the hell of it. I don't expect it, but it could happen. So that's the kind of terms I'm talking in.
Right.
I'm saying probably, most likely, you know, just because that, you know, I'm thinking realistically, but there's still, you know, I still have hope, but most of my hope is just that my whatever is left of my life will be reasonably pleasant.
Do you get angry?
Not really, not anymore. I mean, I get angry sometimes, but I'm not generally a very angry person. And in fact, that's one of the things that's changed too. When I first got diagnosed, I was angry at the cancer. I sort of, you know, you tend to anthropomorphize it, personalize it, sort of try and say, I'm going to get you, you know, whatever. And over time, I've come to think that less. I mean, cancer is not malevolent. It doesn't have a brain. It's not trying to do anything. It's my own cells that are malfunctioning, and they don't stop growing when they're supposed to. That's really what it is. And I think being angry is corrosive in its own way. In fact, even treating it as a war on cancer, a battle against cancer, fighting cancer. I wrote this in another blog post. I don't like those words, because that's saying I'm in a perpetual war, like the war on terror or the war on drugs, that I can't win, and I'm going to be a soldier until the end. And I don't want that. That's stressful. And it's a bad metaphor, because it means I'm fighting all the time. And yeah, I've done a lot of fighting, I've done a lot of treatment or whatever, but I don't want to think of it in terms of negative emotions. If I, you know, there are negative emotions. I'm sad. I'm frustrated. I'm upset. I wish things had gone differently. But being angry, I don't think in the long term is going to be good for me or anybody else.
I'd be so pissed off.
Well, I was, but can I be angry continuously for 4 or 5 years? What good's that going to do? What kind of person is that going to turn me into? Is that the kind of person I want to have been at the end of my life? You know, you sort of think of, you know, I think of it in some ways as if I've just become a young guy in an old man's body. You know, I'm near the end of my life. And if I was 81 instead of 41 and I was angry all the time, I'd be a stereotypical curmudgeonly old man that nobody liked and nobody wanted to see. And I, you know, those kind of people end up dying alone. That's not what I want to be. So I consciously don't want to be angry because there's no one to be angry at. There's no one who did this to me on purpose. I guess that's why I'm sort of annoyed at the conspiracy theory people, because they seem to think it almost is something that happened on purpose, but it's not. It's a mistake. It's a random error in my cells. So that sort of stuff happens. I've said to people, one of the metaphors I use is, you know, anybody could get hit by a bus. I've been dodging buses for 4 years, and now there's a bus coming that I can't get out of the way of. I don't know exactly when it's going to arrive, but it's coming. But it's nobody's fault. So getting angry has no purpose.
And you have managed to maintain a sense of humor through all of this.
Kind of have to. My wife always says, if we don't laugh about it, we'll cry about it. So we've made some dark jokes, particularly to each other, but sometimes in public as well. And other people are sometimes uncomfortable with that. But the nice thing about playing the cancer card, which you get to do when you've got cancer, is you can just say, well, sorry, I'm going to tell some jokes sometimes. You're going to have to live with it. You'll have to take it. So, yeah, I find that helpful, much more helpful than being angry, certainly.
I'm dying to hear one of the dark jokes.
Well, I mean, sometimes they're a little nerdy, but, when, you know, online on Facebook, there's all these social media gurus and search engine optimization people who are telling you how to get more traffic to your website. So I said, you know, social media guru tip of the week, trademark, I said on Twitter, simply announce that you have a terminal disease on your blog and watch the traffic roll in. Ask me how. Because, you know, all you got to do is develop the disease and announce it, and there you go. You got tons of traffic. Now, you know, most people aren't going to take that advice, but that's the kind of jokes that I might tell. So, you know, and I find that liberating, I guess, to be able to say that sort of thing. I'm not generally, you know, the guy who will tell mean jokes, but if I can tell them at my own expense, that's fine.
You've been very generous with your time with CVC and certainly sharing everything on the blog. Has being this public about it been at all therapeutic, or is it just that we keep asking?
No, absolutely. I've sought it out. Again, you know, I wanted an audience. I'm kind of a ham. I've also worked as a musician for more than 20 years. Drums and some guitar, and I sing, and you know, I've worked in wedding bands and all this sort of stuff. I like to be on stage in front of people and make a fool of myself and have people pay attention to me. So, you know, this is a sucky excuse for a way to do it, but it's not not bad. I had been interviewed on CBC for other things before and enjoyed it, totally unrelated to this. I always wanted to be on the radio or on TV, that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's a way to satisfy those urges I've always had for sort of publicity. And I have found talking about this stuff online, on the radio, in whatever context, I've found it more therapeutic than the therapy and the focus groups and other stuff I've tried. In part because I'm dealing with, you know, online especially, I'm dealing with people who are sort of in my peer group, as people who've been interested in online stuff for a long time, and sort of technology and things like that. So they're my friends. A lot of them have become good personal friends. And it's also a way to get support. And it works all the time. You know, if I'm feeling crappy and I can't sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm on Twitter, there's people I know out there you know, and if I complain about it, they're like, oh, sorry to hear that, you know, anything I can do, or just, yeah, you know, I know how that can be, or I don't, or I wish I could do something. And, you know, if you have a therapist or whatever, maybe you can call them at 3 o'clock in the morning, but they're probably not going to be too pleased about it. Whereas people on Twitter, they're happy to talk to you, and, you know, maybe they're in the UK, it's already the middle of the day for them, and that's fine. So I've actually found having all this stuff online very helpful in thinking through stuff. And in addition to that, I've written a lot of stuff about, you know, what I think about death and sort of philosophical stuff. And doing that, knowing people will read it and evaluate it, and that it's going to be there for a while, I've had to think about these things perhaps more seriously and more thoroughly than I would have done otherwise. So I've probably taken more time to consider what it is I really think is happening to me and what I think about that and how it makes me feel. I've probably looked into that more than I might have done otherwise because I'm writing it for people to read.
You said a few minutes ago that that you don't like the process of dying, but the death itself is something you don't fear. How did you get there?
Well, I guess I'm an atheist. I'm not somebody who thinks there's an afterlife. I guess it's just a logical conclusion. Once I'm dead, I think I'm dead, and there won't be me anymore. So there's nothing to fear there because I won't be around any more than I was before I was born. You know, all the thousands and millions of years that I wasn't here before, I won't be here again. And it didn't bother me before I was born, and it's not going to bother me after I'm dead. So that's, I don't know, I guess that's, as part of this philosophical thing, that's just kind of an illogical conclusion. It's the getting there that I'll still be aware of. Once I'm dead, I don't think I'm going to be aware of anything, so there's nothing to fear.
But you fear the moments leading there.
Well, maybe not even the moments. I'm hoping that the moments might be relatively comfortable, but I've gone through a lot of nasty treatments and side effects and symptoms and whatever else, and I've felt a lot of pain and nausea and suffering, and I don't want to do a lot of that again. You know, I don't know if it's worse than what other people have gone through. You know, but I have said that a lot of the sort of things I've gone through, if they were not medical treatments, if they were not the side effects, they'd be prohibited by the Geneva Convention. You couldn't do this to people, you know, just to make them suffer. And, it's that unpleasant. but you know, I was doing it for a reason and I got through a lot of it. I'm just hoping there's not a lot more of that. As I get sicker, I'm hoping that we can manage the pain and the discomfort so that I'm in at least reasonably comfortable shape as long as possible. That's the stuff. And there are a lot of, you know, resources through the Cancer Agency and elsewhere, palliative care, that I think in general as a society we're getting better at over time, that I hope will benefit me in that sense, because I don't want to be in bad shape near the end, because again, that's not going to be it's not even good for me, and it's not going to be a good memory for my family if that's the way it goes. So I want to avoid it.
And finally, what is the question people ask you most often on your blog or on Twitter or via email or Facebook or anywhere else you are? I mean, people you don't know, the curious.
What do they ask me? It's funny. I think they don't ask me. I can't think that there's something in particular that they ask me all that often, because I try to address the questions when I write it in the first place. So, you know, they may have some specific questions about, it depends on who's writing. Some right. people, they want to know more about, you know, I'm going to take chemo and what's it like,
right.
Or, you know, I'm going to have this particular procedure or whatever else. And you had it. Can you tell me what it's like to go through it? That's the sort of thing that strangers ask me. But really, you know, if it's people who know me better than that, they're more likely to just ask, you know, how are you doing? Not in the what's the latest update, but how do you feel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the great thing is, one of the questions people ask most often is there anything I can do for you? And the funny thing is, I often don't have an answer for that. And I've had to think about that some more, because there are things people can do. And I'm not used to actually seriously trying to figure out what those might be, but I'm probably going to need some help with stuff, and there are things that I would usually do that maybe other people can do for me. Mm-hmm. And it's even a matter of, you know, maybe you can make a stew and we can just keep it in the fridge and then we don't have to cook something. And, you know, my mom does that, but my friends have offered to do that sort of thing. And they've offered to give me rides places if I need it. I'm still fine for driving most of the time, so that hasn't been necessary a lot. But those sort of things will come up more. And I think that's a very reassuring question that I think is probably the most common one.
And how are your daughters doing?
Surprisingly well, I guess. And I think the reason for that is that we've been honest with them about this right from the beginning. When I first got diagnosed, we didn't think it was that serious. We thought we may be able to get it treated and cured. But even then, you know, we told them, and they were pretty young, you know, 7 and 9 at that point, I guess. Not even that. Yeah, around that. And we told them, you know, this is serious. This is a disease that I might die from if we don't, you know, and that might happen. And we've talked about it that whole time. And they've been to some, you know, kids groups that they have through the cancer agency. And we've seen family therapists and stuff to talk through this stuff. It's not always easy for them to adjust. You know, sometimes they're not feeling well in a general way and need to stay home from school. And maybe they're sick or maybe they're just reacting to how I'm feeling. But that's okay. I like to keep talking to them about it. Mm-hmm. So I hope they're as prepared as they can be. And they've been here the whole time. They've seen what kind of stuff I've gone through and how sick I've been and how miserable it can be to get treated for this. But you know, we've also had to make clear, because they're kids, that no, this isn't something you can catch. Yes, when you get older, you're going to need to get screened because there's a history in your family now, but you can get it early and get treated and you'll probably be fine. But it's not something that, you know, and because they're kids, we have to make sure this is not something that's in any way your fault or that you could do anything about. Stuff that adults don't necessarily consider, right. But we've had to make sure that we've addressed those and that we continue to address them, and just that I'm here. So yeah, it's hard for them. It's hard for my parents. It's really hard for my wife. It's hard for me. But sometimes things are hard, and that's a lesson in life too. And you can get through it. That's the message I've tried to get to them, and I hope they can.
We will talk again, I'm sure.
I hope so. I hope I'm around long enough to do that. Last time we spoke was more than 2 years ago, mm-hmm. So it'll have to be sooner than that, most likely.
It's really good to see you.
Thank you.
I was expecting you to look worse.
Yeah, well, I'm thinner than I'd like to be, but I bought some clothes that fit me better, so I look okay. And I've still got my hair, so there you go.
So in everything you've been saying, in the blogging, in you talking to me right now, is there a point to all of this? I mean, is there something that... some message you're trying to get out there?
Well, I think it's related to a lot of stuff like the recent Movember campaign and the underwear affair race where people raise money by running around in their underwear. One thing I'm trying to do is to get people to talk about not just cancer, which there's tons of stuff for, you know, breast cancer awareness and benefits and whatever, but the uncomfortable stuff. I mean, this is butt cancer ultimately that started this for me, and people are uncomfortable if something's going on in that region. A lot of people aren't comfortable going to the doctor and talking about it, but I am telling you, go to the doctor and talk about it. If something's going wrong, if you're over 50, you need to get screened for it. It's not that bad to get a colonoscopy. It really isn't. They give you drugs that knock you out. You don't even know what's going on. And if there's something going on in any, you know, anything like that, anything that you would be uncomfortable to talk about, it is worth going and getting treatment and getting a diagnosis or even finding out that everything's okay. It's way better to do that than to end up like me, although I got treatment as soon as I could, but you could easily end up dead very fast and very uncomfortably and very unpleasantly. And I think that's probably worse than any embarrassment you might suffer talking to a doctor. So I think that's probably what I'm trying to tell people. And what some of these other humorous campaigns are trying to do is that, you know, make it a bit of a lighter thing so that we can talk about our health to doctors, to our friends, to our relatives and families, and maybe have better health as a result. So there you go.